Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
He was always seeking the truth. It was actually his mission for writing. He talks about this, as a matter of fact, in his 1932 book, Death in the Afternoon. And he says, talking about himself as a writer, that what he was after was the real thing. And he capitalizes real thing. And he said what he's trying to do is to tell something in a way that will make it last, that will make it just as true in 1 year, 5 years, or 10 years. And if a writer has luck and states it purely enough, always. So this is sort of almost a missionary zeal he has to tell the truth. And he talks a lot about wanting to get in touch with what he really felt about something rather than what he thought he was supposed to feel about it or had been taught to feel about it. And it was really to drill down and to try to capture the authenticity of experience that was always a goal of his. He could be flippant, he could be sarcastic, he could be cynical about just about everything, except writing was a sacred subject to him. He really was truly devoted to trying to always push himself one step farther. Ezra Pound told the young moderns to make it new, and make it new was sort of the rallying cry of modernism. And Hemingway took that lesson to heart and was trying to make it new in everything he wrote throughout his life.
For a true writer, each book should be a new beginning, where he tries again for something that is beyond attainment. He should always try for something that has never been done or that others have tried and failed. Then sometimes, with great luck, he will succeed. The helpful and pragmatic words of American novelist, short story writer and journalist Ernest Hemingway. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Were there one or possibly 10 Ernest Hemingways? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack that question using the direct, uncompromising and wonderfully expressive letters of Ernest Hemingway, 1926 to 1929, with Sandra Spanier, the general editor of the Hemingway Letters Project, and ask who and what was Ernest Hemingway and why does he produce such strong reactions?
Hello, I'm Sandra Spanier. I'm the Liberal Arts Research Professor of English at Pennsylvania State University and the general editor of the Hemingway Letters Project. We are producing, in a projected 17 volumes, the complete scholarly edition of the Letters of Ernest Hemingway by Cambridge University Press. This is a complete collection of the author's some 6,000 located surviving letters. It is authorized by the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and by the Hemingway family. We're fortunate to have the special interest of Hemingway's sole surviving son, Patrick Hemingway, who was the one who wanted a complete scholarly edition of his father's letters, which puts him in the same class as D.H. Lawrence, Charles Darwin, Mark Twain, other major figures who merit having all of their correspondence collected. Patrick's feeling is that it should be all or nothing. He didn't want any picking or choosing, which is why we are publishing everything we can find. This ranges from telegram cables, to 14-page, single-space typewritten letters. So it's really a massive project.
Sandra, really well done on the collection of letters. I have to say you've really nailed it there when you say all or nothing, because while all the letters to me were so interesting, there's some very pedestrian stuff, there's some deeply heartfelt stuff, very intimate stuff, very uncomfortable stuff, and then others that are just kind of quite whimsical and everyday. So you really get an all or nothing side to Ernest Hemingway. I'm just wondering, as I was progressing through the series of letters, I began to think, does anyone really know Ernest Hemingway? Because he was such a giant of a man, this great symbol of masculinity and, you know, tough and straight talking. Yet, when we read through a whole variety of different letters, we get so many different aspects to his personality. He's so complex.
That's right. And his first wife, Hadley, said exactly that. She said that he was had so many sides to him. He was so complicated that you could hardly make a sketch of him in a geometry book. And the value of the letters and the interest of the letters is exactly that, that we see all of those different sides to Hemingway, the tender side, the vulnerable side. He could be a very macho, to be sure, but there's so much more to him that gets lost with the public persona.
Yeah, four wives, seven novels, and I think six short story collections. In some ways, it's quite easy for this his big personality or his enormous public persona to get in the way of the fiction, isn't it? Because there's so he blasts out masculinity and in some ways that humanity around it.
That's right. And even as early as the 1920s, when he was a young upstart writer on the left bank of Paris, he was still a large figure. Even in 1926, when he came back from a ski vacation in Schruns, Austria, where he was working on a book that then we came to know as The Sun Also Rises, the Paris Tribune actually, in its gossip column, noted that he was back in town and it looked as though he'd put on a few pounds. So even in 1926, he's quite a notable figure.
He spoke Spanish, Italian, French, and obviously English, which is it just shows you what a capacity he had in so many different ways. How do you think it affected his writing style, his ability to understand languages? Because clearly in the letters, he flips between a lot of different styles and words and even down to the grammar. It's between different languages. So I'm just wondering, do you think that had an impact on his overall writing?
So, but I think it also just is evidence of his love of language. He had a very keen ear, and he loved wordplay. He loved puns. He will, in his letters, for example, he'll say Christ knows, but he spells it C-H-R-I-S-T-N-O-S-E as though it's a single word. Or he's in Arkansas, for example, staying with the family of his second wife, Pauline Pfeiffer, and he said this is a Christ-awful place, and it's Christ and then O-F-F-A-L, Christ awful. So he loves that kind of wordplay. But yes, he did pick up on languages very quickly. In the first volume of letters, which spans 1907 to 1922, we see him in Italy during World War I as an 18-year-old volunteer ambulance driver. And he is trying to impress his sister with his Italian, and so he goes off onto these Italian phrases. I passed these by a professor of Italian here at Pennsylvania State University, and she just laughed because she said that a native Italian speaker might have no idea what he was trying to say, but because she teaches young people Italian, young native English speakers, she knows exactly what grammatical mistakes he's making. So the use of other languages was not necessarily perfect, but he was quite fluent. And apparently he learned to swear very fluently and idiomatically in Italian very, very quickly.
It's in contrast, though, to his writing style, which was quite sparse and deceptively simple in parts, isn't it?
Very much so. He was the master craftsman and extremely disciplined in his writing. It's amazing to see the labor that went into things that look so simple. There are manuscripts among his papers at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, and you can go look and see how he would, in some ways, overwrite a scene or a description and then start stripping away the adjectives until he got down to the bare bones of a sentence. He rewrote the ending of A Farewell to Arms 47 times, and all of those 47 drafts are preserved at the Kennedy Library. Fortunately, Hemingway was a pack rat and kept absolutely everything, so it's wonderful to be able to look at his thought process and how he made decisions to get just the right word for his published work. But on the other hand, his letters are just sprawling, and he will even make comments along the way. He'll write something, and then in parentheses, he'll say, probably misspelled, or go look it up if you want to know the spelling, something like that. So there's this ongoing sort of meta commentary on his own spelling and grammatical imperfections. But he did not consider letter writing to be something he wanted to invest a great deal of his intellectual energy in. He just dashed these things off. and they capture his mood of the moment, the events of the day. So there's a great sense of immediacy in the letters. He'll talk about his malfunctioning typewriter and curse at his typewriter while he's writing a letter, for example. Or he'll talk about how the kids are crying in the other room. Gives a much more human, down-to-earth picture of him.
Just coming back to those 47 drafts, is that absolute artistry or is that psychotic perfectionism? Because you could look at that so differently, couldn't you?
Well, that's a good question. I think at this stage of his life, it's perfectionism, absolutely. He believed very deeply in art, in writing. If he had a religion, that was it. And he was a very zealous apprentice in his early days in Paris in the 20s, and he listened to advice of writers like Ezra Pound and Gertrude Stein and F. Scott Fitzgerald, and then he found his own voice and really took off with that. But he would definitely labor over his published work, but I think it gave him great satisfaction. He said he was never happier than when he was living in that country making those scenes. He talked about that in relation to the composition of A Farewell to Arms, for example, years later.
In your introductions, you write that the letters are unpolished, unselfconscious, candid and casual. It got me thinking, isn't that what we want from a communication, really? Because you want that burst of freedom and honesty and that immediacy, don't you?
I think we do. That's, again, it's refreshing and it gives us insight into him as a person. His son, Patrick, who's, again, been just wonderful about answering questions and giving insights into his father's work, he compares a writer to a pope. And he says a pope does a lot of talking, but when he speaks ex cathedra from the chair, that's very different. That's the official word. And Patrick was sort of comparing Hemingway's work for publication as the pronouncements of a pope, whereas just his daily conversation was much different in tone and substance.
Sandra, there's a lovely letter to an American painter and writer, a friend of Hemingway. I think it's dated the 1st of October 1928, and it's unbelievably encouraging and supportive and really straight up. And it's completely different to the hard-drinking, big-game shooting, super macho Hemingway that we see. It's part of that kind of Hemingway myth. He's very supportive and very emotional, and we see this superb friend. He's trying to encourage Waldo to write. I think he's got writer's block or something, and he writes something on the lines of, "My God, it's hard for anybody to write. I never start a damn thing without knowing 200 times I can't write. Never will be able to write a line. Can't go on." And then it goes on to say, that you have to just knuckle down and not stop. It's a beautiful letter, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. He's very encouraging of other writers and really gives them pep talks almost. In this letter to Waldo Pierce around October 1st, 1928, he says, "Why the hell don't you write some pieces? Don't start as a novel if that is too bloody long and keeps your nose on the grindstone too long, but start as anything, a story or any damn thing, but then finish it." That's in capital letters, "but then finish it." He goes on to say, "The only thing to do is to write it. I never think about anything else. Why the hell should you? Write it. If you want to write about anything, mother, father, brother, wife, bootlegger, bastard son, or anything else, for God's sake, put it in. There are no punches pulled in literature. If you pull them, they walk out on you." And then he goes on to say, "My God, it is hard for anybody to write. I never start a damn thing without knowing 200 times I can't write. Never will be able to write a line, can't go on, can't get started, stuff is rotten, can't say what I mean. No, there is a whole fine complete thing, and all I get of it is the bacon rinds. You would write better than anybody, but the minute it becomes impossible, you stop. That is the time you have to go on through, and then it gets easier. It always gets utterly and completely impossible. thank God it does. Otherwise, everybody would write and I would starve to death.
It's so refreshingly honest, you know, when you have these writers up in ivory towers or so you think they are. But he goes on somewhere to say, look, write 500 words a day. And it got me thinking, God, if you apply yourself in that, use that as a kind of a frame on anything, whether it's gardening, whether it's cooking, whatever it is that's floating your boat. If you just apply yourselves and use the kind of the 500 words a day, you become a master eventually, don't you?
That's absolutely right. And that is reflective of his own writing practices, too. He would get up and even before breakfast, first thing in the morning, while everything was fresh in his mind, he would write. And 500 words was a good day for him. So he's not going on, usually not going on these sort of long binges of writing, but instead, he did do that sometimes, but generally very, very disciplined, very methodical. And you can trace the progress of various works through the letters because he's giving page counts in letters to his friends so that when he's writing A Farewell to Arms, for example, we can track the progress. I'm on page 166 or I'm on page 361. Also, sometimes when he doesn't put a date on a letter, we have to use clues like that, like the word count of a novel or the number of miles on his car's odometer if he's going on a trip and try to put these letters in the proper sequence. But yes, he was very quantitative that way with himself too. He would write down word counts of what he'd accomplished each day.
One of the things I was very curious to read about, and you highlighted it also in your introductions, is that Hemingway wrote letters in clusters. And you say somewhere that, you know, he was very aware of his audience and he kind of tailored a letter to who and what, whoever he was sending to. But within that, one of the odd things was that he used to write a letter to his mum and dad, on, let's say, on the same day, and he'd mail them in separate envelopes. It's almost like he compartmentalized his relationship with his mother and his father while they were living in the same house and how he communicated to each of them independently. Is that a bit strange?
Well, I think it's actually admirable because he's not just writing a generic dear folks or dear family letter as an obligation. He did do that occasionally. But in this volume, we do have two letters written on the same day to each of his parents, and each one is very much a conversation with that parent as an individual. So that with his father, who was a physician and an outdoor enthusiast and a wonderful shot, he had apparently amazing eyesight and taught Hemingway how to hunt and fish, which remained lifelong passions of Hemingway's. To his father, he will talk about the species of animals he's seen or the number of fish he's caught, plants he's seen. And yet to his mother, who was a master musician and then took up painting, he talks about art, he talks about opera, talks about music. So I actually think it's indicative of the fact that he was having very tailored individual conversations with people he was writing to. And I see that as a mark of sincerity and really wanting to connect.
There is what can only be described as a stunningly heartfelt letter he sent to his father. I think it was in September 1927. It was on the breakup of his second marriage to Hadley. And it's over 3 pages and it's unbelievable. He wrote it between the 9th and 14th of September. So he wrote it over 5 days, which is interesting because, you know, we live in with technology now and computers and how you can draft. And it's interesting to see how he actually did it logistically and all the rest. And he was describing the breakup in the marriage and what it meant to him and how personally he took it and also why he chose not to tell his parents when it actually happened. And I think the media caught up with him and his parents found out. And it is a stunning, as I said, a stunning letter. I might get you to read from a bit of it because it is such an open communication. It makes it such a wonderful reading.
This is a very interesting letter because he broke up with his first wife, Hadley, and was having an affair with their mutual friend, Pauline Pfeiffer. And he and Pauline had been married then in Paris in May of 1927. And apparently he neglected to tell his parents, who were very upright citizens of Oak Park, Illinois, a very straight-laced upper-middle-class community west of Chicago. And his parents actually read about his divorce in the newspaper and were quite hurt. So one of the things we also have in the course of researching the letters is because he was such a pack rat, we have thousands of letters that he received. And so it's possible to oftentimes put together the letters he wrote and see what he was responding to. So in this case, his father had written to him on August 8th, "Oh, Ernest, how could you leave Hadley and Bumby?" That's their son, John. "Your dear mother and I have been heartbroken over your conduct." He complained that he and the family heard of Ernest and Hadley's divorce through public announcements in newspapers. And Hemingway writes somewhat in the voice of a wayward son. It's a little bit defensive, but he's trying to make his parents understand. He makes some excuses, too. He's writing and says, "You cannot know how badly I feel about having caused you and mother so much shame and suffering, but I could not write you about all of my and Hadley's troubles, even if it were the thing to do. It takes 2 weeks for a letter to cross the Atlantic, and I have tried not to transfer all the hell I have been through to anyone by letter. I love Hadley and I love Bumby. Hadley and I split up. I did not desert her, nor was I committing adultery with anyone." That's not exactly true. "I was living in the apartment with Bumby, looking after him while Hadley was away on a trip, and it was when she came back from this trip that she decided she wanted the definite divorce. We arranged everything, and there was no scandal and no disgrace. Our trouble had been going on for a long time. It was entirely my fault, and it is no one's business. I have nothing but love, admiration, and respect for Hadley. And while we are busted up, I have not in any way lost Bumby." This is not an entirely honest and complete confession to his father, but he's trying to make his father understand. He goes on to say, "You are fortunate enough to have only been in love with one woman in your life. For over a year, I had been in love with two people and had been absolutely faithful to Hadley. When Hadley decided that we had better get a divorce, the girl with whom I was in love was in America. I had not heard from her for almost 2 months. In her last letter, she had said that we must not think of each other, but of Hadley." What in fact happened was that when Hadley found out that Ernest was having an affair with their friend Pauline, she was, of course, terribly hurt, but asked that the two of them remain apart for 3 months. And if at the end of 3 months of no communication, they still wanted to get married, then she would let him go, would give him a divorce. So that's why Pauline was in America, not because she happened to be, but because she went there to make their separation less difficult. So he's presenting the facts in a way that he thinks might be the least hurtful to his father and also that make him look a little bit better.
Yeah, it's quite the spin. I read the letter and I said it goes on for nearly three pages, at least four or five times, because I found it such a monumental moral cop-out in the most exquisite style. I said, Jesus Christ, I can learn something here and copy and paste this in at some other stage in my life and opt out. But it got me thinking, how conscious really was he of the consequences and the different decisions that he made? Because he seemed to be in places in his life coming from this selection of letters quite deluded in some ways, or that he didn't somehow come to grips with the consequences of whatever was happening at the time, that he lived in this very kind of compartmentalized world.
Well, I think, in fact, he did understand the consequences of breaking up his marriage with Hadley. It was a wonderful marriage while it was in its full bloom, and he wrote very nostalgically of his marriage to Hadley in his Paris memoirs, which were the last thing he was working on before he died in 1961 by his own hand. They were published after his death as A Movable Feast. But these letters are extraordinary because they take us back to that very time. He felt tremendously guilty about what he was doing to Hadley. He wrote a beautiful letter to her, as a matter of fact, talking about how much he admired her and about how the luckiest thing their son would ever have would be to have her for a mother. And at the very same time, he is writing to Pauline, whom he wants to marry, in utter despair, and it's one of the first times he brings up the possibility of suicide. He is in such despair, he's thinking about suicide because of the misery he feels he is causing other people and the torment that he's feeling himself. So he felt things very deeply. He may, when talking about it to others, certainly in that letter to his parents, there he is shaping the narrative, but we also get the raw emotions in other letters that he wrote to Hadley and Pauline. So that's the beauty of the letters, is that you hear all these different versions of things in different voices to different people, and you have to sort of triangulate to figure out what's actually going on. But that's like life itself. It's not a clear, straight narrative, and you're always having to try to piece things together and figure things out.
Let me put this another way then, Sandra. Do you think he learned from the messes? Because, okay, you know, he went through so many different relationships, and he seemed to have repeated some of the messy stuff throughout his life. So I'm just wondering, did he learn from it? Like, there's one thing being putting your hand up and being consciously aware and saying, yeah, I messed up here. But there's a second thing to actually learn from the messing of, you know, to learn from your mistakes and actually not to make that mistake again.
Well, I think he was a very conservative person at heart, so that when he fell in love with someone, he went on to marry that person. Actually, there's a conversation that he had later in the 1940s with Marlene Dietrich, who had just met Mary Welsh, who would become Hemingway's fourth wife. This was in Paris near the end of the Second World War. And reportedly, Marlena, after meeting Mary Welsh and having known Martha Gellhorn, who was his third wife, who was an intrepid war correspondent and a wonderful writer, very strong figure, apparently Marlena Dietrich said, "Ernest, I can see why you would want to sleep with them, but why do you have to marry them?"
So, it's a great one, isn't it?
Yes. So I think he had that very conservative core, and it was constantly, you know, he was at war with himself in certain ways. But you're right, he did certainly repeat patterns.
How important was Maxwell Perkins to his overall literary career? Because he was such a genius editor, and he discovered F. Scott Fitzgerald, Thomas Wolfe, lots of different writers. So I'm just wondering, you know, if Hemingway had not met Maxwell Perkins and had not had such a deep professional and personal relationship with him, is there an argument to say that Maxwell made him the writer he became?
He was a tremendously important figure for Hemingway. In terms of Hemingway's art, I don't know that we can say Maxwell Perkins made him into the writer he became, because Hemingway, he did not edit Hemingway the same way that he edited, for example, Thomas Wolfe, who would present crates of manuscripts and Perkins had to help him edit it into publishable shape. In Hemingway's case, what Perkins did was to recognize what an amazing talent he had and to persuade Hemingway to come over to Scribner's and to change publishers after his first American book came out. And in order to do that, he actually took a book of Hemingway's that was not such a great novel, called The Torrents of Spring, which people don't read too much today. Maxwell Perkins took that book in 1926 so that he could get Hemingway's next book, which turned out to be The Sun Also Rises, or Fiesta. So he saw Hemingway's talent, he nurtured that talent, he became a lifelong friend. He actually came down to Key West, Florida, to pick up the manuscript of A Farewell to Arms when Hemingway was done with it, and Perkins hand-carried that back to New York on the train and wrote Hemingway a wonderful letter from the train saying what a beautiful book it was, offering Hemingway a record-breaking contract for $16,000 for serialization rights in Scribner's magazine. So Perkins was a tremendously important, influential, supportive figure for Hemingway. And in terms of providing him a publisher he could truly believe in and who truly believed in him, that was the great value of Perkins to Hemingway.
There is a terrifically bitchy letter to Maxwell Perkins dated from the 26th of October 1927. It was a letter Hemingway wrote where he was talking about literary reputation and he was having a go with Virginia Woolf. And it is so nasty and acerbic and deeply competitive. I was quite surprised actually by it. But then I thought, well, you know, he was kind of such a high voltage man and had a lot of capacity and a lot of energy and a lot of drive. And sometimes that can get you into different darker spaces at times. And it clearly came out in that kind of ruthless competitive instinct. I might get you to read from it, if you wouldn't mind.
I think this letter is very emblematic of Hemingway's distaste for mistrust of professional literary people. He was not someone who enjoyed being in a literary coterie. He hated New York critics, for example, and I think he viewed the Bloomsbury group as the type of literary coterie that he did not particularly admire or feel comfortable with. And Virginia Woolf had written a review of his short story collection titled Men Without Women. And in this review, she had come out and said something to the effect that the softening feminine influence is absent either through training, discipline, death, or situation. But she counters that the greatest writers lay no stress upon sex one way or another. And she also criticizes D.H. Lawrence and James Joyce, saying that they partly spoil their books for women readers by their display of self-conscious virility, and Mr. Hemingway, but much less violently, follows suit. Well, this really irritated Ernest Hemingway, and he wrote to Max Perkins, who had sent him a clipping of this. And Hemingway writes, "The Virginia Woolf review was damned irritating. She belongs to a group of Bloomsbury people who are all over 40 and have taken on themselves the burden of being very modern and all very promising and saviors of letters. When they are all busy at it, they dislike what they consider the intrusion of anybody much under 40 into the business, though God knows one doesn't wish to intrude. They live for their literary reputations," that's capitalized, "and believe the best way to keep them is to try and slur off or impute the honesty of anyone coming up." Of course, where they are right is that literary reputations in one's lifetime are plants that can be nurtured and blighted, and they do their best to nurture theirs and their friends and throw off on the others. Well, God be with them. So I think this is the view of a young writer. He's only 28 at the time, complaining a bit about the over 40 establishment who have staked a claim to being modern. So I think there's partly here just a bit of youthful rebellion against what he might see as an establishment that's not understanding him or letting him in.
He gets pretty full on, though, as the letter progresses, and really wants to take Virginia Woolf down a peg or two, to put it mildly, to really poke at her. But I suppose it's possibly naive to think that writers don't get competitive. And when other writers are commenting on equally as talented other writers, they can, get sufficiently cheesed off. Although when I was going through those, and I found this other letter to T.S. Eliot, where he apologises for writing a kind of something nasty about him, a bad review. And he had publicly insulted, I think, Eliot in the Transatlantic Review, and he had quite a go at him. And so he wrote him quite a personal correspondence, and he was quite embarrassed, and it was a very heartfelt apology, and he showed a very self-aware side to him. So there's so many sides, isn't there?
Absolutely, absolutely. Actually, back to the Virginia Woolf letter for just a minute, he tries to explain why he's so irritated by what she wrote. He has this conflict because on the one hand, he gets very irritated by reviews, and on the other hand, he is constantly asking people to send him clippings of the reviews. And we know he kept them in big scrapbooks. Those survive at the Kennedy Library. What he says, though, in that letter to Perkins about Virginia Woolf, he says, "I'm working hard and the damn things are irritating and make you self-conscious, especially the ones that misunderstand either on purpose or through dumbness. When a thing is misunderstood, you want to explain, and that going on in the head is bad for working." Virginia Woolf was not the only critic that he railed against by any means. But I think it made him self-conscious, and yet to see what other people were saying about his work, and yet he craved knowing what other people were saying about his work. So that is very contradictory.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with Sandra Spanier, Professor of English at Pennsylvania State University, whose latest publication, The Letters of Ernest Hemingway, 1926 to 1929, has just been published by Cambridge University Press, where Sandra writes, "Hemingway always drew a clear distinction between writing letters and writing for keeps. Hemingway did not recognise the letter as one of his strongest and richest genres." I asked Sandra about Hemingway's approach to the truth, both in his fiction and in his private life.
He was always seeking the truth. It was actually his mission for writing. He talks about this, as a matter of fact, in his 1932 book, Death in the Afternoon, And he says, talking about himself as a writer, that what he was after was the real thing, and he capitalizes real thing. And he said what he's trying to do is to tell something in a way that will make it last, that will make it just as true in 1 year, or 5 years, or 10 years, and if a writer has luck and states it purely enough, always. So this is sort of almost a missionary zeal he has to tell the truth. And he talks a lot about wanting to get in touch with what he really felt about something rather than what he thought he was supposed to feel about it or had been taught to feel about it. And it was really to drill down and to try to capture the authenticity of experience that was always a goal of his. He could be flippant, he could be sarcastic, he could be cynical about just about everything, except writing was a sacred subject to him. He really was truly devoted to trying to always push himself one step farther. Ezra Pound told the young moderns to make it new, and make it new was sort of the rallying cry of modernism. And Hemingway took that lesson to heart and was trying to make it new in everything he wrote throughout his life.
The Ill Man in the Sea was the first Hemingway that I read. I think I was in first year in school, so I was around 12 or 13. And then later I migrated to A Farewell to Arms and The Sun Also Rises. And they're such marvellous books. I'm just wondering, though, how much of Hemingway is in those books? Because a lot of readers who know a lot about the life feel that we do get a lot of Hemingway, but others see it quite differently.
One thing we can see from his letters is how very closely he drew upon life experiences as fuel for his fiction. But it's always important to realize how much he changed, too. He was certainly not writing straight autobiography, but it's instructive and interesting, for example, to read the letters home from the Milan hospital after he was wounded as an 18-year-old in 1918. And then to compare that with his 1929 novel, A Farewell to Arms, where he's using very same experience of an ambulance driver who gets severely injured and ends up convalescing in a hospital in Milan and falls in love with the nurse. Hemingway draws all of that straight from his life, and yet he transforms that into something much more lasting and far that extends far beyond autobiography. He was passionately involved in the Spanish Civil War, raising money for ambulances for the Republican side. He participated in and narrated a propaganda film called The Spanish Earth, trying to get the Western democracies to support the Spanish Republicans. And when that cause appeared to be lost, and he went back home, actually he went to Havana instead of to Key West, because by that time he was having an affair with Martha Gellhorn, and he didn't want to go back to Key West and his family home with the wife and the kids. He used that experience, and in 1939 immediately plunged into writing For Whom the Bell Tolls, which is a great novel about the Spanish Civil War. In the case of The Old Man and the Sea, he drew there upon his experiences living in Cuba. He lived in Cuba longer than he lived anywhere else, from 1939 until his death, really. He left in the summer of 1960 after the revolution, not knowing he wasn't going to return. He thought he was coming back. He got very ill on a trip to Spain, ended up back in the U.S. being hospitalized, and committed suicide the next summer. But the point being that he was very much a part of the fabric of his town in Cuba. His friends were fishermen, and he reflected very much the kind of character that he observed in some of these simple fishermen that he met in Cojimar, Cuba. So he draws upon that experience. The Old Man and the Sea is almost a parable-type book.
It's such a captivating read, and with a teenager's eyes, it makes it even more beautiful. But I think the thoughts in it resonate no matter what age you are, because it is so hauntingly beautiful. I'm just wondering, you stated at the start of the interview about Hemingway's son, Patrick Hemingway, who was very, very committed to the project and wanted a warts-and-all type letter structure. or letter format. But Hemingway in 1958 wrote a directive to his executor stating that he didn't want his letters to be published. So I'm just wondering, you're an academic scholar, literary scholar, and I'm wondering, how do you balance those types of wishes with, I suppose, the demands of literary history?
Well, fortunately, that wasn't my decision to make. That was a decision that was made, first of all, by Hemingway's widow, Mary. She decided, after observing that wish for two decades, that she would authorize a volume of selected letters that was published in 1981. And that was the first time people actually saw some of Hemingway's letters. Patrick, I've had a number of conversations with him about this. And he said that that has actually always puzzled him, because Hemingway must have known that there wasn't a chance that his letters wouldn't be published if he didn't destroy things. So again, that's a decision that the family made, the estate made. I, as a scholar, get to have the amazing experience, rewarding experience of putting together these volumes, which will be the definitive edition of his letters, which will be, in effect, his autobiography that's written in the continuous present tense, day by day, very unselfconsciously.
You write in your conclusions that Hemingway's letters present more challenges to the reader and editors than one might expect from a writer so renowned for simplicity. His obscure personal references, ever-evolving nicknames, in-jokes and offbeat private lingos that were shared with particular correspondents at the times is virtually impenetrable. I'm just wondering, you spent so much time with him. This project is an ongoing project. We have so many letters to publish in this and so many volumes. Are you getting closer to him now, do you think? And will we ever know Ernest Hemingway?
Well, I certainly feel as though I know him probably as well as I do anybody in my own real life right now, because I'm so deeply immersed in these letters that he wrote to so many different people. It's such a privilege to have access to these materials, and they're endlessly fascinating. I have found I can read handwriting that I think is perfectly clear and obvious, but other people have trouble deciphering. So I'm so steeped in this that, yes, I do feel as though I know him fairly well. But on the other hand, he's so complicated and so complex, and he changes all the time, too. He's presents different voices to different people. So he's quite a complex protean character. I wouldn't be so presumptuous as to say I would ever really know him or anybody, actually.
And Sandra, if you went out on a date, let's put it this way, whether you would date him or not, I'm not quite sure. But what would be the thing that you'd like to resolve with him? Because you know his life and you've seen the ups and downs, the challenges, the mistakes, all the messy stuff. What question would you really like to get to the back of, find the truth on?
Oh, that's a really hard question. I happen to be very interested in his relationship with Martha Gellhorn, whom I had the privilege to meet a few times. She lived from 1908 to 1998 and was forever resentful at being known as Hemingway's third wife. In the letters that he wrote after their breakup and letters she wrote, they both are so incredibly hurt and bitter about each other, and yet I think that each of them found really their match in the other person. So I guess I would want to ask him about Martha. They each wrote a play. The only play that either of them wrote features the other person in caricature form. Hemingway wrote a play called The Fifth Column about the Spanish Civil War, and there's a character there named Dorothy Bridges, a beautiful blonde who's in Madrid during the war. She's not very flatteringly portrayed, and that was written right at the height of his relationship with Martha Gellhorn. Very shortly after the end of the Second World War, Martha Gellhorn and Virginia Cowles, another woman war correspondent, friend of hers, decided that they would write a play called Love Goes to Press, which clearly features a caricature of Ernest Hemingway. The play is about two women war correspondents on the Italian front in World War II, and at this press camp, they run into the ex-husband of one of the women, and she had divorced him because he had stolen her stories. So it's kind of a comic depiction from Martha Gellhorn's point of view of the competitiveness that Hemingway felt with her, which she claimed to me she never felt with him. But I just find it fascinating that the two of them, really for the rest of their lives, spoke in very intense terms about the other. Martha Gellhorn was the only one of Hemingway's four wives to leave him, and I don't think he ever got over that.
That was Professor Sandra Spanier, the general editor of the Hemingway Letters Project. The Letters of Ernest Hemingway, 1926 to 1929, is edited by Sandra Spanier, Rene Sanderson, and Robert T. Trongdon, and retails for just under €35 in hardback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Brunock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the perceptive words of Ernest Hemingway from his iconic novel, A Farewell to Arms. There isn't always an explanation for everything. How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.